session. First order of business is roll call. Jim Patrick, here. Bill Brannigan?
I'm here.
Bob Berman?
Here.
Screen sharing, see?
Jim Hasselman?
Here.
Gary East?
Here.
Braulio Escobar?
Here.
John Updike?
Here.
Dustin Capri?
He's not gonna make it.
Greg Sutton? I thought you said Greg was gonna be here.
He's on Zoom.
Oh, he's on this, okay.
Yeah, he was.
Is he on the phone, Zoom?
Yes.
Okay.
He's muted. Let me ask him to unmute.
There. I tried to unmute.
Alright.
Yeah, I don't know if you can see me.
And Annie McGreenery?
Here.
Okay. First up is unfinished business, 2A, identify candidates for city center revitalization project, stakeholder advisory committees. Derek?
Yeah, thank you. There's, just as I mentioned in my memo in the packet, current status on this is the state through the Oregon Department of Transportation will be putting out what they call a mini RFP. As part of the TGM program, there's a pre-selected group of consulting teams who can make proposals on these types of things. And so they're in the process of getting that RFP out on the street. And I've been advised that that will be released probably towards the end of the month. And then we can expect that the consulting teams will have then probably about 3 weeks in November to get their proposals in. And so I expect that, you know, we'll have at least two, possibly three proposals come in. When we've used the state's mini RFP program in the past, that's typically where we land. You know, sometimes maybe up to four, probably not more than that. As you may recall, we have a team selected to review those proposals when they come in. And that involves one planning commissioner, one city councilor, myself, the city manager, and David Helton, who's the ODOT liaison on this project. So five of us will be evaluating those proposals, and you've seen the criteria before. So I expect by the time it's all said and done, and they've negotiated, you know, we've selected a consultant and they've negotiated a contract, we're probably going to be starting in earnest on the project shortly after the first of the year. Timing wise, that makes sense in terms of how that's going to play out. But one of the things I wanted to do, because I think it's so that we can start to get this framed out a bit, is once we get going in earnest on the project, I'd really like to not be in scramble mode in terms of putting together some of the public engagement expectations. And so this is just a conversation to begin to frame that somewhat so that we have that information available to us when we're talking to consultants. And ultimately, once a consultant's selected, we get going on that kind of thing. And we already have identified kind of how we're going to want to tackle some of this. So, you know, with this particular project on the city center revitalization, the scope of work as it stands now includes one overarching citizen advisory committee. And I included the stakeholder groups or interests that have been identified as being interests we want to see on that overarching advisory committee. And at the end of the day, the city council would be doing an interview process on this kind of thing to vet candidates and ultimately select candidates to fill those spots. So what I had included in the packet, so what they're, you know, for the overall advisory committee, we have the city council and planning commission liaison on that committee, which is pretty typical. A representative from Lincoln County, a representative from the school district, a representative for fire and emergency service providers, at least one representative of the local business community, one from a faith-based organization. We want to get somebody who is a mixed-use or multifamily housing developer, because again, we're trying to attract as part of this whole reworking of our rules and transportation facilities down there. We want to make it more attractive for mixed-use development. We want to make sure that we have somebody who does that type of development on the advisory committee. Lending institution rep, architect or engineering design professional, somebody from Centro de Ayuda. They are actually, their office is in this area. And Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development will have one representative on the overall advisory committee as well. My suspicion is that the council would also want a few public, general public seats as well, but also trying to be sensitive to how large the advisory committee is, because you usually don't want them too big, otherwise it becomes unwieldy. But you also want to make sure it's not so small that you don't have enough or representative group of people that you want on that committee. So before I move to the next piece, I guess I'm going to stop there. This is an opportunity for you, if you believe that there are stakeholder groups that are missing here, now's a good time to raise it. If you have thoughts, other thoughts on the on that.
Well, just it's probably not missing, but you have one Lincoln mm-hmm. County representative.
Yeah.
Is that going to be, obviously, transportation is a big part of this. Shouldn't Lincoln County Transit be directly represented?
Okay. It's a good thought, Bob.
I assume it falls under local business representatives, but you're going to probably have to get the chamber involved, too.
Okay.
This isn't a visioning committee or process, is it?
No.
That has already taken place.
Right.
But I agree with, perhaps it was the city council you mentioned, that there doesn't seem to be, and the likelihood of any of these groups representing actual residents from this area is doubtful. And I don't think city council lives there. I don't know if anybody here on the planning commission lives in that district or area. I mean, you're close.
No, I'm actually in that district.
Oh, okay, you're actually in it.
If I remember how they drew the line, it's behind my house.
It's behind your house.
But I really do think you need to have residents from that area on that committee to have them, their voices heard. That's the last group you ever want to sat on the sidelines if we want to have support as a city. I also think, as reasonable as any of these other groups, is to include farmers market. I don't know why a farmers market representative isn't there. This is their home, and we have done nothing to allay their fears with a redevelopment plan to where, I mean, it's much like the animal shelter, which has fallen off the radar. Promises are made and promises are unkept. So sorry to be so brutally honest here, but I think we honestly need to start to listen to residents who actually reside there. Not landlords, because they're often absentee, and some of them don't care what happens down there. As along City Center, you see 3-4 buildings in a row now up for sale, and that's good to see. The owner probably doesn't want to do anything, so move on. That's good. But I think this group here is it's the usual suspects, and I don't think mm-hmm. the usual suspects always get the best answers. I mean, they have their view in their professional lane, and that's what they're shooting for. And so I think we miss out on a lot of what the community needs, even as hard as it is to get community to be involved. I mean, we don't have anyone new running for city council. That should tell you something about the involvement of the citizenry. It's hard to get them motivated, but they need to be part of this process. And this list that's here, I'm sorry, doesn't do it for me. I mean, it might do it for some people here, but it doesn't.
He just did say that the city council is going to want a couple of at-large public representatives.
That's fine, and I'm supporting their suggestion.
Okay.
As a member of the Planning Commission, and I believe my opinion was just requested. So that's why I'm giving it in strong verbiage.
My other comment would be if the committee is so large, it's going to be unwieldy. Mm-hmm. And as time goes on, it will, there'll be attrition. Like I'm on your, mm-hmm. on your housing workforce thing. Mm-hmm. A couple months ago, you know, we had to fill up this room. Now we're lucky if we have three or four attendees. So,
Boy,
that's another factor to keep in mind. I think a more focused group might be more more amenable to come up with some good ideas with the consultants.
As an aside, just to add to my lengthy comments, I do understand that there are residents of that area who are trying to put together a neighborhood group, much like NYBEC, and they are a little frustrated with understanding what they must do to do that. But the fact that they're trying to do that suggests to me that they do have an interest in what goes on in their neighborhood.
I assume you're talking about the Highway 20 area, right? Up the 101 corridor?
Well, this is all mostly 101. It's city center folks that have been talking to me.
But, oh, okay.
I don't know about...
City center businesses or city center residents?
Residents.
Okay.
There's a group of them that are trying to mobilize and are new at it, and they don't know what's required by the city in order to form an association, much like NYBEC has.
Okay.
So they're trying to do that, and it's a learning curve for everyone.
As far as other entities, should we consider Samaritan as a member, since they are the largest employer in the area? And while they're not in the focus area, they're pretty close. They're within the overall area, and they got an awful lot of employees. A lot of those employees do frequent the businesses in this particular area.
Thanks, Bob.
And you're also going to realize you're not going to get all of them anyway.
True. But we should open the process to a wider audience.
Oh, yeah, I'm for that. I'm not.
We're only going to gain more opinions.
I don't think it relates directly to that list, but in my mind, one of the key properties in the study area is the armory.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how you even go about opening those discussions, but I brought it up several times, and I don't know. It seems like there ought to be some kind of concerted effort.
Is that city property, by the way?
No, it's owned by the state of Oregon.
It what?
It's owned by the state of Oregon, Oregon Military Department.
And there's no taxes that come to us from that because it's a governmental agency, state-owned. Is that correct as well?
Correct. It's public.
I don't know how heavily it's used. I've never seen what goes on there. So
it's for available for rent. I've seen a lot of different activities, like the
sure.
dog trainer lady uses it, and
yeah, but the guard yeah. The guard doesn't use it.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they use it. I just have never seen any activities there.
Neither.
I see their equipment parked in the fenced-in area, but
no, they muster there once a month.
At least so, 1 weekend a month.
For like 2 days, 1 weekend.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good.
I want to say that we tried to get them to potentially move down to the airport to free that particular property up, and were rebuffed by the National Guard.
There's a really nice parcel down there.
Well, as I've said before, I think it's important enough both to this project and to the city to potentially even get some elected representatives involved in those discussions and what it would take for them not just to blow us off.
Oh, you mean with respect to the armory?
Pardon?
You're talking still with respect to the armory?
Yeah.
Well, it kind of also makes some sense from an emergency preparedness side that if the bridge goes down, and we have military equipment over by the airport, it sure makes staging helicopters in and out of the that particular airport together with the C-130s that would no doubt come in a heck of a lot easier if the National Guard was over there.
Any other thoughts on the overarching advisory committee?
Doesn't look like it. So, all right.
I was only partway through. Sorry, Jim.
Okay.
Yes. That was it. This is an ODOT project, right?
No, it's a city project, and you know we applied for the funds.
Okay.
The bulk of the funding is coming from the state of Oregon through their Transportation Growth Management Program, which is a collaboration between the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. When we do projects through the Transportation Growth Management grant process, we have a lot of influence over, you know, what's in the scope of work and how the process is structured. And so, I mean, this is very helpful feedback. At the end of the day, the state is the one that administers any kind of consulting contract. It's not, here's the money, city, you go and hire your consultant and do it. It's, you know, one of these pre-selected consulting teams that have already been vetted by the state and DLCD, that they have the qualification to do this kind of work, understand what the state's, you know, policy priorities are, in addition to, you know, what local governments may want. And, as you go through, they're the ones handling the billing. They're the ones dealing with situations if the consultants are not producing on time or if we have to negotiate changes in the schedule. All that dissimilar to TSP in that regard.
But my point was, obviously, a major, major part of this whole thing is looking at US 20 and 101, and should ODOT be involved directly?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would hope that one of the ground rules for the committee here is not to get themselves enmeshed in couplet or not to couplet, because that's a real hot button issue. But that, to me, that's out of the scope of this particular activity.
Well, one of the things that we're going to have to resolve with this is which of the two transportation solutions makes the most sense based on what we're trying to accomplish down here. And that's going to need to be a product that comes out of here. It would be a decision on that front. Because it's going to be paired with a number of other changes, whatever that transportation solution is going to be paired with changes on the private side to try to attract the type of development we're looking for and the reinvestment we're trying to get in this area. We talked about the overarching advisory committee, but then the other piece to this, or a couple other pieces to this, is right now the way we have the scope of work structured, and that can be adjusted somewhat as we go through the RFP and ultimate selection, is, you know, you have up to 6 stakeholder groups. The concept here is that, you know, a lot of what we're going to be doing, we want to have interactive between the consultants, staff, and public, which is very hard to do if you've got an auditorium type environment. And so the way we've structured this is, you know, up to 6 stakeholder groups. We didn't define the exact numbers, but I mean, you're talking about smaller groups, maybe 12, maybe up to 20 people, where over, say, a 2 or 3 day period, you know, the consulting team can come out here and we can actually have good dialogue and back and forth with folks. And, you know, we may want to do some illustrative charrettes, you know, where we do mock-ups on the wall, that kind of thing, which is really much more conducive to a smaller group environment. And so one of the things I was looking for your help with is to, considering what our project area is, with the US 20 and 101 both being within this focus area, is if we're breaking it up into maybe a half a dozen different stakeholder groups, what that might look like. And maybe we go with topic area emphasis on some of it, you know, where it's those that are interested in housing, maybe issues might be in one stakeholder group. Maybe those that are more interested in transportation side of it in another. maybe those that are interested in public space, like the farmers market or gateway entrances, maybe that's another stakeholder group. But then you could also have some that are more, like you suggested, I think, with the hospital, we could have a stakeholder group that's largely the hospital, because that kind of is the southern anchor of this area is going to be the hospital. So anyway, I'm just curious what your thoughts are in terms of how that might be structured such that we get good representation, because that those stakeholders, we're going to hold a number of those through the course of the project, and they're going to help kind of shape and inform what's presented to the overarching advisory committee as part of this. And then keep in mind, there will be full public, you know, activities as well, but, you know, I think there's going to be three of them right now in there. But when you go citywide, how you engage has to change somewhat. So that may be large open house, that could be online surveys, but when you're doing full city outreach, it's going to look a little bit different. Yep. So on the stakeholder groups, I'm just curious kind of what your thoughts are in terms of how those might be structured so that they're effective and we get good engagement.
I like your idea of the hospital, but I wouldn't call it hospital. I would call it medical. Community.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's one building down there that has my eye doctor in it, who's not part of the hospital at all. Mm-hmm. And the 1010 building, of course, has a lot of facilities. That's in the area, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So medical. I would think it would be productive small session to invite all of the business owners that front Highway 20 within the study area at one time and get their thoughts on the proposals.
Highway 20, independent of the Highway 101?
Hmm?
Kind of separate from the Highway 101?
Right. Okay. And then maybe another one with all the business owners fronting Highway 1, because they're separate issues. They're different concepts and different problems. So that might be, there's a couple of possibilities.
I think a smaller group, maybe seven, would be ideal. And I like the discussion that we've had about outreach to the affected people. I think we saw that perhaps there wasn't adequate outreach initially with the South Beach comprehensive plan change. And so if we get ahead of the curve and reach out to the citizens who'd be affected and who it would be a, could come up with a plan that would have more community-based acceptance.
And I'd suggest that when you do the notices, be a little liberal. I mean, if it says everything within 200 feet, it doesn't hurt anything except cost a couple of bucks to go 300 or 400 feet to make sure that you get a good representative sample of people in a particular area.
Sure.
I'd also, I'd suggest that one of the focus groups should just be the Hispanics. We do have within the area several, I guess, Mexican restaurants and a lot of the wait staff is. And the Hispanics, you know, because of language difficulties that they're thrown in with a lot of other retail people, they're just not going to speak up. So, you know, if like Beatrice was running a separate one for the Hispanic community, we'd probably get more better feedback.
It's a good thought in terms of being strategic in terms on bringing in bilingual resources for outreach. And if we want to make sure that we have at each step of the process, one of the stakeholder groups is one where, you know, if you, you know, you aren't a native English speaker, there will be somebody there. But we may need also really reach out to get folks to actually attend and participate. And there'll need to be some champions in that regard. Put some thought to that.
One thing that I've found successful is in that early stage when you're doing the wider outreach, some process of determining a weighting of what of those issues are most important. You know, you ticked off five or six different topics of interest from transportation to housing to business community, but it would be good to gauge what's top of mind, what's last on the list of seven critical items just so that the consultant team can focus, you know, the 80-20 rule, so that we don't get lost in something that ends up being a very minor item from a community concern standpoint.
So you kind of talk about like weighting critical success factors.
Right.
Which you know, in terms of the end product, these are the absolutes. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Or these are the highest priority issues that we want to get out of this?
Priority issues and a sense of what are measures of success. So when we're when this is done, did we hit the mark? Right? So it's I think it, I'm just sort of building on Jim's point of making sure we're listening to everybody possible and then, you know, bringing that feedback back at the same level of priorities that we're hearing.
Good.
Anything else on that particular topic or?
Is now the time to select a member of this commission to be nominated to serve on that group, or is that come later?
Well, we can, from the planning commission?
Yeah.
We can do that later. We'll have an opportunity to, as we get a little bit closer to the project.
Okay.
Kind of kick off. Otherwise, I lose track of where it was in the sequence of minutes. If it's too far back.
Sure, you'll remember.
So, any other thoughts? Did you have any thoughts on the overall full public outreach piece to it?
No, but the only thing is, I think it should be a little bit more successful this time because we're not facing COVID stuff. So maybe get a. That's been our.
Well, especially on something that, you know, we were looking to do those kind of design charrettes as part of our scope of work with the DSP, and then COVID hits and we can't do any in-person meetings and we end up having to retool the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that was challenging. But we do have to keep in mind, I think you make a good point though, we don't know where pandemic related issues will go. So we need to be prepared to adjust if we have to. But at least now it's a known commodity. It's not going to be a total surprise.
Yeah. If we can do it like we did the original South Beach stuff, I think we'll get a good product.
Mm-hmm.
But if we got to go through what we did with the system transportation plan, I don't think we're going to get a really good product.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the original South Beach stuff, which one are you?
Yeah, the one from 10 years back that we're doing the can't think of what
urban renewal
stuff. Mm-hmm. That whole process. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really good in South Beach.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't think the transportation planning one was, but you just constraints. I mean, it's
right.
Like you did the best we could with what we had to work with. If we can stay off the COVID thing, then I think we'll get a good product out of this. So
sure. Yeah, that's all I had on the. I've got some good notes here. What I'll be doing with this information is kind of distilling that into some bullet points when we pick up the conversation with the city council, just to make sure, because at the end of the day, they're going to have to be comfortable with how it's structured, and we're going to have, you know, an application process and where they'll do interviews and vetting before they make their appointments. So I think that's more or less how it's going to work. But appreciate your thoughts. Trying to get on top of this a little bit early so that we have this more or less hammered out once the project goes in earnest and we're not scrambling to catch up.
Okay, now we're on to 2B, short-term rental ordinance implementation work group recommendations.
Yes, and Bill, please feel free to chime in, and you do need to make a trip to City Hall here in the next few days to sign that letter.
Yeah, I'll be... I'll be in Wednesday morning probably, or tomorrow afternoon.
So the short-term rental work group made its held its last meeting on the 30th of September, and they've signed off on the letter that I included in your packet, and that will be presented to the City Council at their upcoming meeting on the 17th of October, along with the attached draft ordinance, which includes some language in there. And so what the council then will do is they'll pick it up, and if they agree with the recommendations from the short-term rental work group, then they would initiate the legislative amendment process and send the ordinance to you as the Planning Commission for further consideration and the docketing of a public hearing, so you can hold a hearing on it. So one thing process-wise I wanted to chat with you about is, if they do that, do you want to take it straight to a public hearing, or would you like to hold a work session in advance of the public hearing? Would be one piece.
How about a public hearing and then have a work session to kind of digest what the public had for the input?
Kind of like we did the last one?
I don't see any of these being big enough to even justify a work session.
Okay, I just wanted to see where you were at with it.
That's just my opinion, but okay. These are all basically tweaks.
Well, let's see where the discussion goes this evening, and that might give us a better idea of whether we need to have more time on it or not. Because I have no idea what the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of you and are thinking about this. I only know my own thoughts.
And we don't really know whether the public wants a lot more than just tweaks, yeah. Right?
You mean, okay, so your thoughts are take it straight to a public hearing as drafted, you know, and presented, mm-hmm. and then see what the public says, and based on that testimony, decide whether or not you want to schedule a second hearing for straight-up recommendation or go to a work session and do some tweaks based on the testimony. Did I hear that right?
I
think that's fair.
Some of the mines in the minefield.
Yeah. Bill?
That's a good thought.
Can you hear me?
Bill, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I take it you're on the work group committee. Can you explain why the committee wanted to, on bill point one, why they wanted to establish a grace period between the closing of one sale and the new owner getting a license, allowing that that entity to operate without a license during that interim term?
Yeah, I think the interim term we were talking about was 30 days. And what it essentially was, a lot of the VRBOs, they book, you know, weeks, months in advance. So you have somebody that's already booked a vacation. We have the change where somebody, you know, a change of the ownership where the new owner has to come in and apply for a business license and potentially have the house inspected. So do you just now have to cancel everybody's vacation that had been there, or do you give the new owner a short period of time to continue on with the vacation and then get all the paperwork done?
Is it possible for the new owner to apply for the license while the transaction is still in escrow prior to closing?
I'd have to ask. I don't know that. We didn't really have that discussion, but maybe Derek can shed some light on that.
Yeah, as it's structured now, no. The way this ordinance was drafted, somebody had to have actual possession of the property to be able to apply for a license or get on the wait list.
So this is why they included that individuals or entities that purchase vacation rental properties, one that is established as a vacation rental.
Right. That grace period only applies to those vacation rental dwellings that are in or adjacent to commercial property, where, you know, if you're buying an existing licensed vacation rental on C2 or adjacent to C2, then you basically get to take the slot that prior owner had and just pick it up, but you have to get a license in your name. And as Bill said, the issue we've run into, which is an understandable one, is that these types of situations where they can sell it as a vacation rental means the seller is invariably selling it with clients booked up through the spring or summer. which is different than most other types of all the other type of vacation rentals. They're not transferable, so to speak, and so those just go away.
Well, how does a new applicant move up into the on the waiting list if the existing folk can sell their license to a new buyer?
Because those that actually have licenses in the C2 are only a fraction of the overall number. A whole lot of the licenses that are in the permissible area are in R4, R3 areas, where when that individual chooses to no longer operate a short-term rental or they sell their property, you know, whoever buys it goes on a wait list. They don't get to immediately operate it. And the principle there when we did this retool in 2019 was if a vacation rental dwelling is in a residential area, you know, once a vacation rental, not always a vacation rental. That was the issue that you had a lot of testimony on. Whereas in the tourist commercial areas, there's an expectation, has always been an expectation, that vacation rentals are part and parcel with what you have in the fabric of a tourist commercial area. Therefore, that was the one area where it was reasonable to, if somebody has made the investments in establishing a vacation rental, that they could sell that, you know, as a vacation rental to a buyer. So,
can anyone share with me businesses? How many businesses that require licenses to operate are allowed to operate without a license?
Yeah, like a restaurant, say.
You mean
like
business licenses?
They have to get a new liquor license after you purchase a restaurant.
I'm talking businesses in general. Yeah, if you have to have a license to have a business, this says, well, you don't have to have a license to have the business open. And I think that's a mistake. I think, yes, it's a different kind of business, but how many businesses could come forward with that same argument?
Our typical business licensing is one where you often have a situation where somebody has established and then they come in and get the business license.
I think with the OLCC, Bob, even before closing, the applicant does a pre-application process because there's a background check. You can't buy a bar or an entity and start serving alcohol until you have the OLCC license
right.
in hand.
Okay, well, that's not maybe not a good example, but what they're saying here is it's only the endorsement that you don't have during those. You still have to have the business license on day one.
But the endorsement is required to operate. That's one of the rules we wrote in. So either they need an endorsement or they don't to operate.
Well, it's just not fair to somebody to cancel a month's worth of reservations while they do some paperwork. I know if I had booked out 6 months in advance with a family retreat in Nye Beach that we've been doing every year for the last 20 years, and all of a sudden somebody calls up and says, well, we transferred ownership to another. It's going to be a vacation rental, but not this month. You're out. That's just not a reasonable burden to put on a business.
I'm sure customers would be upset. I've had that happen when someone's gone out of business. They've retired, and they've had to call and say, we can't do this anymore. The doctor's retired. He can't see you anymore. I mean, this is also typical of life in America. We don't always get our dreams. And sometimes the greatest plans still go awry, totally out of our control. So I just think it's odd to, in this case, provide the opportunity to operate a business when you're not completely endorsed or licensed.
I think it's a reasonable accommodation for an odd circumstance. And also remember, this only applies to the ones that are actually in the commercial districts. Doesn't apply to the residential ones. And the whole idea behind this entire thing and the cap is to shift the ones out of the residential into the commercial area.
Well, we don't have anything about that here, though, do we?
Huh?
There's nothing here about shifting them out. So your argument is only good on...
No, if you give up one in the residential district, how are you going to get one in the residential district?
Well, if it's outside the zone, that is correct. But if it's inside the overlay, they can still do that. So my point is just, even if it's a minimal number that are in a commercial zone currently, I have no idea what that number is. I'm just saying that I think it's inappropriate to have a business operate when they haven't been fully endorsed or licensed.
Jim, perhaps the answer would be to have the new entity, the new purchaser, do a pre-application process with Derek's office. And so that once it closes at escrow, the title company, they can walk on down to Derek's office and pick up their license.
That's a fine
solution. So there isn't a big gap there.
There is.
No, that's a fine
there are
solution.
Other requirements. They have to have an insurance in place.
So they could have the policy in place beforehand.
I doubt it.
If I go buy a car, they're
sure,
not going to
if I tell
drive
an insurance agent I'm going to buy that building across the street,
I drive the car
give me
off
insurance
the lot
on
insurance
it.
Every time I've ever bought a car.
Don't
because
think
because my insurance policy says I'm covered for something that I buy, but that doesn't work for property.
Yeah, it's, you have a grace period on
yeah,
your insurance.
You have a
basically.
Grace period on insurance. You don't have a grace period on property insurance and stuff like that. So,
what I'm hearing though is you'd like to take it straight first to a public hearing, as referred down from the council. Hear the public testimony and then decide if you want to do a work session, or schedule a second hearing for action.
On this issue, in addition to the,
you may get testimony on a range of different issues at the public hearing. We get
testimony on the entire.
This is one of those topics where you could expect testimony on a range of different things.
Yeah,
right.
As you know.
And for the work session, I would recommend that we invite the members of the working commission.
That's a good thought, Bill. The work group?
Yeah, the work group.
Yeah, except for we have two council members. I think they would probably prefer not to, I would suspect, to provide that kind of separation from the commission recommendation, but it's a good thought.
But I mean, it could be, they could recuse themselves and
their
the
choice.
Other members.
Yep.
Yeah, Jamie Michelle and company who have, good thoughts.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent thought.
One thought that jumped out at me on how the grace period wording is perhaps it creates a greater loophole than is necessary to solve the problem. So the problem is unique, right, in that these are booked far in advance. But this creates an opportunity for me to buy a property and start renting it immediately to new renters who haven't been pre-booked. So I'm wondering if we could maybe modify at least that language that the grace period extends for only those occupants booked prior to close of escrow. So we address, the solution addresses the problem, doesn't create a new one.
Yeah, no, I like
that's
that
a good
idea.
I
like the language. I'll be candid, I'm not sure how we would necessarily know whether or not, there was a reservation.
You get a complaint,
before.
Then you may have to ask
sure.
them to prove it up, right? Mm-hmm. So, because typically I would think some yeah. of that
well,
might
okay.
be in some of
you're
the closing documents
that.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So you're transferring
I'm just kind of
sort of a
today.
Temporary leasehold, so that would be addressed somehow in closing docs.
Because you could have a situation where the new owner doesn't want to take existing reservations and make have them cancel all of them because he doesn't like the price of getting.
Thank you. Clear on that.
Yeah, hey. I know. And I appreciate it.
That's the way things sometimes work. I like his suggestion. And we limit it to the existing reservations. And we could, if they want to play games and try to work around it, but for 30 days, you're typically not going to get a whole lot of vacation rental unless that 30 days happen to happen right during seafood and wine or something.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
Delay closing until afterwards then.
Yeah.
To be candid, when it comes to business licensing, and I'm trying to think of a really good corollary, and I guess I could go and take a look at how things played out when the Hallmark purchased the Whaler. Yeah, I have a suspicion that, Ben, I can probably see that, is that transaction closed before they got a business license from the city, and invariably the Whaler was booked and,
still operating.
They tried to make it as transparent as possible, and And so for our business licensing, we invariably have people that are starting to do work before they get business licenses. Sometimes it's an educational piece, especially for, like, say, contractors coming out to do work, mm-hmm. where they've already started working and then, oh, I was supposed to get a business license. So it's not uncommon for us to have circumstances where somebody's been doing some work before they've obtained a business license, which is what this endorsement effectively is.
If everybody would go to, you know, attached is ordinance, draft of ordinance 2022. And there's, if we looked on page, I guess, 8 of 17, mm-hmm. talks about the grace period and the fact that the grace period is 30 days. So it's been a little narrowed, more down, more narrow than what we've kind of been talking about.
Well, I've jotted down that thought about tweaking it. What I can do is make sure that's reflected in the staff report as a potential change, so you at least have that back in front of you when we do hold a hearing on this. The hearing will be booked out a little bit because we have to do a 35-day notice to DLCD, but so that way I'll at least have it in the staff report so you can remember, oh, yeah, we talked about that as being something we might want to do, and then hear what the public has to say and go from there.
And as the new guy, maybe this is obvious to everyone but me, but what's with the magic number of 176?
It's magic.
And we don't want to talk about it
either. We do not want to talk about
yeah.
it.
No.
Down that road.
The 176 was landed upon at the time in 2019 when we went through this overhaul of the city's short-term rental regulations. We took a look at the percentage of our housing that was tied up in seasonal housing. And we took a look at how many units we were typically adding in a year. And we looked at, okay, well, if we limit short vacation rental dwellings to, say, 2% of our existing housing stock, or 2.5% or 3% of our existing housing stock, this is kind of the number you'd want to land on. And so that's where it came out, through kind of that iterative process and discussion. And the way the code was drafted, the thought was, okay, well, we'll set the maximum a little bit higher, but the council, you know, and then the council goes, okay, we'll go with 176 now, but by resolution, we could basically relief valve it over time and ratchet it up a little bit, not to exceed 200. But the recommendation from the work group was, let's do away with the adjustment by resolution concept and just hard fix 176 in the ordinance, which then, you know, means that to adjust that from 176 up, you know, up or down would require an amendment to the ordinance and public hearings, whereas a resolution could be done at any council meeting.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Hey, anything else on that one?
No.
Okay. Last up is the work program.
Yeah, I'm just going to touch on a couple things here. We're all set for the joint work session on the 14th of November. That's going to be your regular work session. It'll be a 6 p.m. start. We should be able to get through. It's all housing. And so Beth Goodman will be here from Eco Northwest, and we'll be going through the housing capacity analysis, which is the first of the two pieces of the housing study that needs to be acted upon. And so the housing capacity analysis is this is what our housing need is. This is how much buildable land we have. We have enough buildable land to meet our need. And there'll be some policy information in there as well, but it's not the full policy vetting, which will be in the housing production strategy. So it's part one, but we're required under state law to get that going. And so we need to get that piece moving through a public hearings process, and we've got it more or less complete. And so I hope you can make it, because that's one where, you know, Goodman will be walking through the different pieces of that. So, you know, you feel comfortable that you at least have a handle on what's going to start going through a public hearings process. Then we actually have two public hearings already noticed for the 14th, so we'll have a public hearing on a CUP from Salem First Baptist. They're going to be doing some exterior remodel, interior and exterior remodel of the Ernest Blockhouse up there. So that's an historic building. You may recall that, you know, any buildings on the city's historic properties inventory, if they want to make changes to the exterior of the building, that has to go through a conditional use process. You guys need to take a look at it and determine if those changes are consistent with the overall historic character of the structure.
The air going out of Bill.
What that was.
And then the other is an appeal of a decision, staff level decision, where we denied a conditional use permit in High Beach, personal service use for the listed office. We didn't find or understand the necessary questions here. What the applicants are concerned, so I don't know if our staff.
Your microphone might be off now. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Still here. We just have some background.
Yeah, I think the background's a little.
Who was the realtor?
It's Realty One.
Realty One.
So this isn't Mr. Beckstead's plan to have a real estate office down next to Port Dock 5?
No. This is in Nye Beach. This is, and remember, in the tourist C2 tourist commercial, we had made a change a number of years ago that made personal service type uses conditional, because we have a finite amount of C2 tourist commercial land, and we want to make sure that that's available for, you know, retail and restaurants, kind of things that make it attractive to tourists. If we have a lot of our typical service type uses in C2, then there's no room for the retail and the restaurants. And so the way that was set up is you have to be able to demonstrate that there's a reason you need to be there. And so we didn't feel that bar was met, but you'll have an opportunity to see whether or not you agree as part of the appeal hearing.
We do have a real estate office, a couple of them down there, don't we?
We have one that was there before that change was made, the one down on
that the one next
Beach
to
Drive.
Stephanie's?
Yeah, that's been down there for many years.
And then in the McEntee's building, isn't there?
There's one, yes.
There's
that's
one there.
The people that came and wanted the television.
Roland Woodcock.
Roland, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And so that's about it in terms of the.
Aaron, you say you can't have another one?
Do you have any idea what we'd be looking at in December and January?
I'll have to map that out and get that to you at an upcoming meeting.
Okay. Sneaking into the holiday season.
Right.
We typically don't have the second meeting in December.
Right, and I don't believe we will have one in the second meeting in December, because it puts us right into the holiday.
26th would be around Thanksgiving.
Are you bringing in the leftovers?
Well, I don't know. I'm not here on the 14th. I'm out of town, so.
I'm fairly confident that December, the first meeting in December is probably where that housing hearing is going to land, because we need to have it before the end of the year to keep the state happy.
I'm happy.
All right. Anything else?
Nope. Got a 5-minute break before regular session.
Business? None. Ooh. So we're okay. This is adjourned till 7 o'clock.
Okay.
I don't want to prejudge that.